G'day everyone, this is B-Jamin, aka The Terrible Aussie, and before we get to the latest episode of the podcast, I'd just like to let you all know that the Super Network, home of the many podcasts that Super Marcy and I host, like the Super Podcast, the King Zone, and Podcasters of Horror, has now got an official Patreon page. If you head to the page right now and subscribe to be one of our patrons, you'll be able to have access to some pretty awesome content and exclusives. For example, if you pledge $2 per month, you'll be able to listen to the latest episodes of any of our podcasts 24 hours before they officially drop online. But if you decide to pledge more per month, you'll receive other bonus exclusives, such as personalized shoutouts from both Marcy and I on our social media pages and episodes on all our podcasts, picking the topic for an episode of the Super Podcast, a chance to have a special guest spot on one of our podcasts, or receive a piece of A4 artwork that was drawn by Super Marcy herself. So head over to patreon.com/thesupernetwork and subscribe there. Now, on to the show.
The following podcast contains coarse language, adult themes, and major plot spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
Everyone, this is B-Jamin, aka The Terrible Australian, and welcome to the 8th episode of the King Zone podcast, which of course is one of our spin-off shows from the Super Podcast. And with me as always is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello Marcy, how are you?
Hello Bede, I'm doing well, just trying to deal with the bipolar Melbourne weather as usual.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't know if it wants to rain, hail or shine, so...
Sometimes in the one afternoon.
Yeah, sometimes within 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Dealing with that, so that's sort of dictated a lot of what I can and can't do. So there is that. Other than that, everything's going pretty well. How about yourself?
Oh, not too bad, thanks. Probably around the time this episode airs, I'll probably be on my holidays. So pretty much I'm just enjoying my time, spending time with family and whatnot. But at the moment, I'm pretty good. Been busy, like I said, in our previous episode of our Podcasters of Horror. I'm currently trying to watch as many films as I possibly can before I write up my top 10 of 2019 list. So hopefully by the time this episode airs, it will already be posted, but we shall see. But then again, though, in my luck, I probably won't be posted until like August of this year.
Yeah, so, something like that.
Yes, but for this episode of the King Zone podcast, it's only just you and I today.
Yeah.
So for this episode, we're going to be talking about two Stephen King film adaptations. We're going to be talking about the 1990 film Graveyard Shift, and as well as the 1991 TV movie Sometimes They Come Back. And I guess for, you know, our listeners, these two are probably kind of the more lesser known,
yeah,
kind of properties of Stephen King, but they do have a bit of a cult following for, yeah, both of them.
Yeah, they both definitely do. And both of the films were based on short stories by Mr. King.
Mm-hmm.
And being that they were released sort of 1990-91, that's why they're kind of grouped together. So, mm-hmm, so short stories and came out not long after each other.
Yep.
So, yeah. That's why these two are together for this episode.
Exactly. So we'll get right to the episode.
Yeah.
We'll start off first by talking about Graveyard Shift.
Stephen King invites you to venture deep inside the caverns below the old Bachman Mill.
You're not thinking about going down in there.
Where a secret lies long forgotten by any living soul.
Just ain't no job worth this.
The workers suspect it.
You can't put me down there. You can't put anybody down there. I know things.
The owner denies it.
What did happen to the fellow that started this job?
It didn't work out.
And everyone fears it.
This place is infested.
That might be the understatement of the year.
Broken?
Because one by one, it will devour them all.
We're like shrimp in an all-you-can-eat salad bar, and that thing ain't stopping till it's full.
Must be some other way out of here.
Yeah! It's fucked!
This isn't real.
This is the new horror from the mind of Stephen King. Graveyard Shift. Good benefits. Early retirement.
Which is directed by Ralph S. Singleton. And having looked up at what else this guy has directed, this was his first and only film.
Oh.
And prior to that, he had directed episodes of the TV show Cagney and Lacey, which he actually did win an Emmy for.
Oh.
So, yeah, I mean, when we talk about this episode, let's, we can understand why this is his only film. But for those out there who don't know what the plot to Graveyard Shift is about, the plot synopsis, which I'm reading off IMDb, is: in a very old textile mill with a serious rat infestation, the workers discover a horrifying secret deep in the basement. And like I said, this is directed by Ralph S. Singleton. The screenplay was written by John Esposito, based on a short story by Stephen King. And the cast of this episode, sorry, this film includes David Andrews, Stephen Mack, Brad Dourif, Kelly Wolf. Oh, and Andrew Dvoff. I don't want to forget him as well.
Yeah, you can't forget him, right?
Yeah, and to kind of start off with, like, I always have been hearing about Graveyard Shift ever since I was, like, young. Well, I kept hearing the reputation that it's one of the worst Stephen King adaptations. It's horrible. Nobody likes it. But at the same time, though, I know quite a few people who actually do love this film, hence the cult following it has. So I watched it for the very first time a few years ago as part of my 31 Days of Horror, because I think there was one day which I did do Stephen King Day, which was with this one, as kind of like I usually do with mine. I do like two horror films per day with mine. And so I picked an older and a newer Stephen King adaptation. And this was the older one I picked. And having watched it now and having rewatched it again in preparation for this episode of The King Zone, yeah, I don't really like this film, to be honest. And I can definitely see why a lot of people do enjoy it, because, you know, I think of Stephen King's work, at least that we have talked about so far for The King Zone, this one is definitely a full-on monster movie. And I know Stephen King has written other monster-based plots before, The Mist being one as well. But this is definitely kind of a, like, his more monster movie kind of centric stories. And I mean, I haven't read the original short story that Graveyard Shift is based on, but I did read up about what it was about, you know, in prep for this episode. And there's definitely quite a few changes from the original short story to the film. But that being said, though, I think one of my main problems with this film and why it didn't really work for me is that it takes itself way too serious.
It does.
And I'm not against the idea of monster films taking themselves serious, but I feel like this one takes it with the kind of concept that it has and the kind of monster that it has at the center of it. It just feels like it takes itself way too serious. And because until you actually see the monster later in the story, it's just basically like this mill that's infested by rats, and these are full-on real rats, so there's no CGI in it whatsoever. And rats can be pretty creepy, but they can be pretty cute as well.
Yeah,
but these ones, like, there's so many of them, and I'm kind of buzzed on how they made all these rats do a lot of the acting in this film. But until the actual monster stuff actually happens, we kind of get really bogged down in a lot of sort of drama between the characters, and it's just not really all that interesting. And also, none of the characters are very likable as well, so you don't really kind of care what happens to them. Even the characters who we were supposed to care about, I just didn't really feel nothing to them, and I think that's mainly because the script doesn't really give them much to do. And, I mean, there are some cool elements in the film, and we'll talk about those, but yeah, to me it's just kind of a even though it's only 85 minutes long, it feels long.
It as well. Does, yeah.
And yeah, it's, and it just overall, it just didn't really quite work for me. What did you think of Graveyard
Shift? Yeah, I know I'd seen it before, and yeah. I think this would go back several years. I can't remember who it was, but I think there was someone at Arrow in the Head who liked this movie and went on about it, and like, you have to watch it. I can't remember who it was. If someone's listening and remembers, please tell me. My memory is, like, that bad. Upon rewatch, yeah, it's really boring. Yeah. It's not all that interesting. Like you said, all the drama stuff is just not interesting. The characters are not interesting or very likable.
Mm.
Like, the main character, what's his name? John? Is it John
Hall? John Hall.
He's so boring.
Yeah, David Andrews, he tries, but there's just nothing to that character.
Yeah, it's just, he's so bland in it, and it doesn't really amount to anything. Even, like, the sort of, the ending when they go down to the basement and confront the creature, it's not that exciting. It's not even really funny.
Yeah.
And for a movie that's about, like, a rat infestation with a giant mutated rat bat thing.
Yeah, which is, just, like, it's never explained.
No, and it's just, it's not, it takes itself so seriously. And when that's the reveal, it's like, why are you taking yourself this fucking serious for that? Like, it just, it doesn't really work. It has some decent moments, but it's just, it fails very, very badly.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And, like, you think, like, maybe it really shouldn't have, but it does.
Yeah, I kind of feel like if maybe they took a less serious kind of tone, it might have worked a lot more, but...
Yeah.
But that's the thing, though. I feel like I said the drama aspects of it, because, like, you got the character of John who comes to the town, and he's a bit of a drifter, but everyone kind of hates him for no apparent reason. It's just like,
because he's...
A drifter.
Yeah, he's a drifter. No one knows him, so let's automatically hate on this guy.
Yeah, and Andrew Divoff is one of the guys in particular who kind of hates him for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
And also there's sort of this aspect, which I think is kind of an interesting kind of underlayer to the story. It's like the character of Warwick, who's played by Stephen Mack, he's like wants to keep the mill open. And so he's like paying off people to kind of keep it open, even if the place is running down, there's rats everywhere. And it's so he's a bit corrupt.
And people go missing.
Yeah, and he's trying to get the union off their back, off his back as well. Like, that kind of stuff is interesting, but it
doesn't amount to anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he's just evil for the sake of being evil.
And he's, like, having affairs with a lot of the female staff, and at one point kind of pushes around and almost wants to beat up his secretary until John steps in and stops it. Yeah. And so I'm kind of mixed on that character. Like, I mean, I think Stephen Mack, he's definitely one of the highlights of the whole movie for me, because...
His performance doesn't match anything else in the movie.
Yeah. And I agree with what you said, is that he's kind of evil for evil's sake.
Yeah.
Rather than just being fleshed out as a character. But sometimes Stephen King villains can be like that. They're just evil for...
AKA every single bully in a Stephen King work.
Exactly. Like, we'll be talking about very soon for the next movie. But... Yes. Yeah, like, I think as a performance, it's really good. Because, I mean, if we're going to despise a character, he does a good job of making us hate him.
He makes it easy, but his accent just did not add up at all. I don't know what he was going for.
Yeah, I don't know what was up with that accent
either. It's just weird, but it makes, like, that performance just even better.
Yeah.
In, like, a so bad it's good way.
Yeah.
But, like, even though there is a mutated rat bat creature who's meant to sort of be the villain because it's a creature that eats people.
Yeah.
No, his character's the real villain.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you're like, no, don't destroy the creature. You're a villain. Someone should kill you or that should eat you. Like, yeah.
You kind of just wait throughout this whole movie just for
his comeuppance,
yeah.
From the creature.
But even then, there's, like, plot holes and logic gaps because you got this creature... Like, it's established that the creature's, like, way below underground of the mill. But the creature can just come out of nowhere, go around the building, eat people, and kind of just disappear without a trace.
Got Jason Voorhees tunnels from, like, the Friday the 13th remake.
At least that made more sense than what it is here.
It doesn't make any sense. I did kind of like some little, I guess you call them like Easter eggs or nods. Like one of the guys is reading Ben.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the follow-up to Willard.
Yeah.
Which was a good nod because of all the rats.
Mm.
And I did not hate the rats at all.
I actually felt, because I mean, I felt
sorry for him. When he's using the slingshot and the cans, I'm like, don't fucking do that to the poor rats, you bastard.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the cans didn't hit the rats. No. Maybe they had like some kind of protective thing to kind of just like, if it hit that, it just, you know, makes them scuttled off. But even then, it's like, these poor rats. I'm all for animal welfare and stuff like that. So it's just like, you know, it's like how the rats are treated in this movie. Yeah. It made me feel like, I want these rats to actually eat all these people.
Yeah, you don't actually see the rats doing anything bad. They're just standing around.
But they are good actors because they could all be in a straight line and look menacing and kind of creepy.
But they're really cute. And I'm like, don't fuck with the rats, you dumb fuck. You know, you're kind of hoping that, you know, it would be a bit of like a Willard situation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that would be awesome.
But sadly, no. There was another, like, Easter egg thing, or whatever you want to call it, that I noticed, which was the mill was called Backman. So, for Richard Bachman, which is King's pseudonym.
Yeah, for some of his novels.
Yeah, like, I liked that as well. Like, those little bits there, things like that are good. I like that.
Yeah, like, Kelly Wolf's character, like, she mentions in, that she's from Castle Rock, which, of course, is a town that's a staple in a lot of Stephen King stories. So, that was a cool little nod. Now, even though, I didn't really like this film, I got to give this film credit for one thing. And to me, this is the best aspect of the whole movie. And that, of course, is Brad Dourif, who plays the exterminator.
Damn. Shit. Tucker Cleveland, Marshall Extermination.
John Hall.
Like one of your buddies got a little too close to the floor. Shit, I'd love to know how many of them Bean town execs are wearing one of your rat-lined overcoats. No, thanks. Give that up.
Why? Shouldn't miss her as much. You work late hours.
I got no choice. Yellow Pages, thick competitors. Why? I don't mind telling you. This place is infested.
That may be the understatement of the year.
Schmuck you work for don't want to hear that. Afraid of what it's going to cost the mill. Thinks a little tracking poison will do the trick. I've been dealing with these things for more than 20 years, and we ain't talking about no candy-ass field mice. These sons of bitches piss on tracking poison. They piss on it to warn their little fucker friends. Take it from me. There's only one way to deal with their kind. On their own terms.
Yeah, he's the only person who knew what sort of movie this was, and his performance reflects that.
Yeah.
That's why he's so enjoyable.
But he's also very committed, because there's this big scene where he's basically does this very long monologue, because he's also, his character's also a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah.
And he talks about like the reason why he hates rats and wants to exterminate them, because he's seen what rats were used for torture in Vietnam. And you watch his performance and you can actually see a literal tear coming down his face and stuff like that. And he is, like you say, it's very clear that Brad Dourif knows exactly what type of film he's in, but he's still bringing a lot of conviction to that role and taking the character seriously enough. I mean, the fact that he's like basically literally crying as he's doing this very long monologue is surprisingly kind of powerful in a way. And like, he pretty much any time he's on screen, he definitely just brings so much to it. But then, of course, his character gets killed off very quickly.
And very stupidly.
Yeah, he gets his head crushed by a coffin.
Yeah. That's it. And it slides down his face after.
Yeah, which is probably even more salt to the wound, pretty much. But
yeah, like, every time he's on screen, you're more invested.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's interesting.
Yeah.
And Brad Dourif always manages to do that with every role he takes. You always find him very interesting and compelling to watch. And yeah, it's no different here. Like, he is a good reason to watch the movie, but then once he's not in it, you're like, this is kind of shit now.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said before, there's plot holes. It's never really established why there's a rat bat creature, but I think, well, reading up on the original short story, like, you know, what it was about, they did make changes. Like, apparently in the short story, there was more rat monster creatures.
Not just the one.
Yeah, and there was different forms. Like, the rat bat creature was in it, but there was other ones. Like, there was, like, these sort of albino weasel-like rats as well, and there was also a queen rat that was about the size of a cow. It had no eyes, no legs, and pretty much was just there reproducing more and more rats. And it's explained that since they've been under this mill, they've evolved over time into these creatures. So they're basically like the creatures from The Descent, in which how they've evolved over time, being underground and that. But I guess they just didn't have the budget to make more creatures, so they stuck to making just the one, which is the rat bat creature. Yeah. But even then, it's just like, yeah, it's this is one I would actually wouldn't mind seeing a remake of.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I think there's a good film in there with that story. It probably could use a remake. Interesting enough, Tom Savini was gonna direct the film in the late 80s, but there was no studio interest.
Interesting, but I think in the same year he made the Night of the Living Dead remake in that same year this one came out. So Yeah, I mean, overall, I think of all the Stephen King properties that we've talked and adaptations we have talked about for this podcast series so far, this one definitely is my least favorite.
Yeah.
And like I said, I enjoy a good monster movie as much as the next person, but I think due to the kind of really poorly written script, the kind of average cast, and also kind of the direction.
Yeah.
It just feels like a very... It just, in the end, just kind of produced a bad film. Like, it is watchable. Like,
yeah.
But it just... It takes itself way too serious. It's a slog to watch. And it's just not as fun as it could have been.
Yeah. If the characters... Or, you know, if it took itself a lot less seriously and they had more fun, it would be a lot more enjoyable. But that's not the case. That's why it just... It falls very flat most of the time.
Yeah, yeah. But I can see why people, like I said, we talked about it has a bit of a cult following. So I know quite a few people who actually do legitimately love this movie. But I don't know. Maybe it's a guilty pleasure. Maybe it's more of a so bad it's good type of film. And I can definitely see it being enjoyed on that level. But I think it's just, I mean, yeah, it has moments like Brad Dourif's performance. But then again, we have said, like, that kind of seems like he knew what type of movie he was in. But I feel like it's too dull of a film to kind of be a fun, so bad it's good film.
Yeah. I'll give it this compliment, though. I would rather sit through Graveyard Shift again than having to sit through Mac and Me again. Just saying.
I think we can agree on that.
Yeah. What would your rating be out of 5?
I think I'd give it about... A 2 out of 5.
Yeah, I'm the same. Yeah, I'd give it a 2 out of 5.
It has its moments, like I said, Brad Dourif being one of them.
Brad Dourif gets a whole point.
And there are some unintentionally funny moments, because, I mean, we haven't really talked about Andrew Dufresne in this whole review, because, as we all know, he played the genie in the Wishmaster films and a couple other films as well. But there's a really funny moment, having rewatched it again. It's like his death scene's funny, mainly because, like, he's sort of sitting there. It's like he's hearing a sound, and he's like, where's it coming from? Lights up here a light.
Even though you can still see.
Yeah, it's still pretty bright. Yeah. And then he just turns around, and literally the rat bat monster is like right there next to him. It's like, how can you not know something's right there?
It's like right there. There's no way you would even need to turn a lighter on to see it was there.
And also some of the stunts in this movie is insane, because there's like a fight scene between John and Warwick and... That's like around bones and stuff.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, like, man, those stunt people must have got banged up pretty hard, because they're landing on skeletons and piles and rocks and stuff like that. Even one stunt where a character falls into water and literally there's like a beam next to it. I'm thinking if that stunt person was a little bit more to the left, they could have fucking impaled themselves on that thing. So
we just have to hope those things were a little bit soft.
Yeah.
Soft for landing.
I hope there's a... I would be down to see some kind of documentary or something, a behind the scenes thing on this whole movie, just to see how this film got made. Because I have a feeling like this is going to be one of those things where the behind the scenes stuff is probably more interesting.
Yeah. It's a weird one. It's a dull one. It's just not the best movie.
Yeah.
It's definitely lower tier Stephen King adaptation.
Yeah. And I can definitely see why this has been put on a lot of people's least favorite Stephen King's list. So
it just doesn't really work.
Yes.
Yeah. So that is our discussion on Graveyard Shift.
Yep. And we'll move right along to the next film, which is the 1991 TV movie, Sometimes They Come Back.
From Stephen King, the modern master of terror, creator of Pet Sematary and Misery, comes an all-new excursion to the place where horror comes alive. This used to be a nice little town, but for Jim Norman, it holds a terrifying secret. Now, 27 years later, he's come back with his family. But they won't be alone.
Live and in person, Mr. Norman.
All he wants is a chance for a new beginning.
I don't want a dream! You're dead, man!
Now, the things that haunt him are about to begin all over again.
Norman. Can Jimmy come out and play?
Starting again, isn't it?
Jimmy, what's wrong?
If someone seems like they're in trouble, they probably are. Why are they after you?
They killed Billy, they killed Kate, and now they want me. Seems they're here to finish up some old business, and we're part of the plan.
Something's left unsettled. Sometimes they come back.
Tim Matheson, Brooke Adams, Robert Russler, and William Sanderson.
No!
Sometimes they come back.
I've been waiting for you, son.
Which is directed by Tom McLaughlin, who is the director behind Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives, and as well as One Dark Night. And the film was, or teleplay, I should say, was written by Lawrence Connor and Mark Rosenthal, based on a short story by Stephen King. And the cast for this one includes Tim Matheson, Brooke Adams, and Robert Russler. Russler? Is it Russler or Russler?
Russler.
Russler, okay. And the plot summary for this one, once again, I'm reading off IMDb, is a man and his family return to his hometown, where he is then harassed by teenagers that died when he was a kid. Now, this one's an interesting one for me, because, like, you know, we've talked about, like, many times in the past on our show, on any of our shows, that I was a bit of a late bloomer to horror. I didn't get into it till, like, my teens.
Mm.
But there were certain horror movies that I remember, like, hearing about a lot when I was a kid, based on, you know, my siblings talking about them or having watched them and then mentioning them to me.
Mm.
Sometimes They Come Back was one of them. I remember seeing the poster around a lot as a kid. And I remember my siblings talking about it as well. So this film, I was already fully aware of, even before I'd never even seen it. And I think I did watch this for my 31 Days of Horror, like, a few years back as well, because I hadn't seen it. And when I watched it then, I thought, yeah, this is actually a surprisingly solid little movie. And then now, having rewatched it again in prep for this episode, I actually liked it a lot more on the second watch, and I got a lot more out of it. And it's interesting to me that this one was actually made for TV, because it doesn't feel like a TV movie.
It actually really doesn't. It feels like a normal feature that you could show at the cinema.
I think it might have been shown in cinemas in other parts of the world, but it was shown on TV in the US. But what's interesting, though, about Sometimes They Come Back is that it was originally going to be a segment in Cat's Eye.
Yes, I read that.
But producer Dino De Laurentiis, I probably butchered his
name. Dino De Laurentiis.
De Laurentiis, sorry. I butcher people's names all the time, so I forgive
We're Australian, we have an accent, what can you do?
Exactly. So I know, because he produced a lot of Stephen King properties in the 80s, some of which we, like Cat's Eye, Firestarter, which we've talked about, and other ones we'll be talking about in future episodes. So he actually, like, again, they were developing Sometimes They Come Back as a segment for Cat's Eye, but Dino felt like the concept alone was actually strong enough it could be its own movie. So they decided to take the story out and replace it with The Ledge. So it took a couple of years, and then they ended up making it, and so it ended up being produced for TV. But it was actually the third TV-produced Stephen King adaptation after Salem's Lot in the 70s.
Yeah.
Then It, the miniseries.
Yeah.
And, of course, this one for as a TV movie.
Mm.
And what I really like about this one overall is it has all the hallmarks of Stephen King's work.
Oh, yeah.
It tackles the type of themes that he loves to explore in a lot of his work. It's about somebody coming back to a hometown and confronting their past trauma or their childhood fears and having to kind of face them. And in a lot of ways, and I mentioned this to you before we even started recording, is that watching this film, it reminded me so much of It, especially the kind of the adult section.
Yeah, it does, because he, you know, from the time from when the tragedy happened as a kid to when he returns, he says it's been 27 years.
Yep.
Which is the same with Pennywise.
Mm.
So, I don't know, maybe the things he was confronting was actually Pennywise?
Possibly.
Could have been, you never know. Yeah, stuff like that really does ring true for like, you know, feeling a bit like It or having similarities with It.
Mm.
And again, sort of, at least in the film version, like the stuff with the train, young kids, older bullies, still it's like It, but also a bit of Stand By Me.
Oh yeah, slash definitely.
The body. So that there is like stuff like that.
Hmm.
It, yeah. But I mean, overall, it really does feel like it's a Stephen King movie because it does have a lot of those things as well. And you know that you're watching a Stephen King film or reading a Stephen King book or story when you have over the top, really hateful older bullies.
Yes, exactly.
Who have no fucking motivation to do what they do other than they're assholes.
Yes. And the, I guess we haven't talked about the cast yet. The main character, of course, being Jim Norman, played by Tim Matheson. I think this is one of his rare kind of lead roles, because he was in a lot of lead roles in the early 80s, but by the time the 90s started coming around, he was more in supporting roles. I think he actually did Drop Dead Fred around the same time he made this film, or at least just afterwards.
Or at least, yeah.
Yeah. And also, Brooke Adams is in this film as well, playing his wife, Sally. And
not her first Stephen King.
Yeah, because she was in The Dead Zone as well, which we will talk about in a future episode.
We will, definitely. And I'm looking forward to that one a lot.
And also Robert Russler, playing the film's villain and the main leader of the bullies, Richard Lawson. And I completely forgot he was in this movie. And for those who don't know, Robert Russler was in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge, where he played the character of... which
Grady.
Grady. I completely forgot he was in this movie. And so it was kind of a shock that he was when I discovered he was in it.
Because this was the first time I'd seen it. So I actually hadn't seen this until 2 days ago when I actually finally watched this movie. So, yeah.
But I mean, I've seen this film before. This was your first time watching it. What did you think of the film overall?
I'm still trying to, I'm actually just looking at, and I probably shouldn't be, Tim Matheson's movies.
Yep.
Yeah, Drop Dead Fred was right after this.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I'm just remembering like other stuff I've seen him in. I'm like, oh shit, okay. Yeah, so yeah, my first time watching it and I really, really enjoyed it. It was, I thought it was a really good movie. It was very enjoyable. Again, I was really surprised that Robert Rossler was in it because for me, like, I adore him because he's in Freddy's Revenge and he plays Grady and I love that movie. Everyone knows how much I love that movie. So that was really cool. And I really liked his performance as the lead bully, Lawson.
Heather, I haven't forgotten that report you owe me.
All right.
Are you Richard Lawson?
Live and in person, Mr. Norman. Just came up from Milford. Real glad to be here, sir.
One thing you have to know in my class, no cigarettes.
No problem, Mr. Norman. Wouldn't want to do anything to upset you, sir.
Take a seat.
I can't wait for you to start teaching me, Mr. Norman. I hunger for knowledge.
Mr. Lawson.
Why do you keep staring at me, Mr. Norman?
I wasn't staring at you, Mr. Lawson.
Oh, yes, you were, Mr. Norman. You were looking right at me.
I was not staring at you.
Well, maybe you're unaware of it, sir, but my old man used to...
All right, look. That's enough. You want to talk about this more? We'll go down to the principal's office, okay?
Yeah, I'm cool.
It's not too over the top.
Yeah, he's very menacy. Like, he brings...
It's menacing, but it's not over the top.
Yeah.
Which I think was really good. Like, he had the perfect look for, like, that greaser-type bully.
Yeah.
And it's always good to see Brooke Adams, because I think she's a really good actress and very, underrated,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I agree.
And, yeah, and as I picked up on when I was, like, when I realized she was in it, I'm like, oh, it's another Stephen King movie that she's in.
Yeah.
So that was kind of cool as well. And I thought Tim Matheson was fairly decent.
Yeah.
Some moments didn't work quite as well as others. It's a little bit hokey at times, yeah, but I think he did fairly well.
Yeah.
The other bullies were a bit over the top.
But I think it kind of works.
But it works though, yeah.
Because, like, you know, you got the character Richard Lawson kind of being the more quiet, menacing type to balance it out, so.
Yeah. And I think it was... bloody name is so stupid. Vinnie Vincent. what was the other one? Was it... No. Oh, can't remember all the villains. The one that was David North?
I think
was
so.
The other one? Yeah. They were, like, more over the top.
Yeah.
Which, it still worked. I really liked their car.
Oh, yeah.
It's the police car.
Yeah, it's kind of like another character in this whole movie.
Yeah, it's not quite Christine, but it's still a cool car.
Oh, yeah.
I liked that. And it is kind of a sad story because the main character of Jim, like, when he was younger, like, the trauma he went through was the death of his older brother.
Yeah, Wayne.
Wayne.
Yeah.
So they're walking, I think. They're meant to be going to the library.
Yep.
And they go through the train tunnel, but the bullies find them there in their car. They pull over, start to harass more so Wayne, wanting money, and I think it's Lawson who gets the knife out. And with a struggle, he accidentally stabs him.
Hmm.
And then the train comes, so the train pretty much kills all the bullies, and Wayne, with him being stabbed and the train coming, dies as well. So little Jimmy was very traumatized, and once that happened, his parents picked up, left the town, and you could see he's obviously been traumatized by this event for his whole life. So he's a school teacher, and the only teaching job he could find was back in his hometown.
And a reason why that is because it sort of insinuates that he's had trouble before in his previous school, and I think it insinuates that he may have anger issues. Probably from what happened there as a child that he's never actually fully dealt with.
So you kind of get the impression maybe he hurt a student or went off too much. But yeah, again, as soon as he goes into the school, like, no one likes him, and it's like, well, why?
Yeah.
There's no reason for people to not like him, and already, like, when he's in his class.
I think that's kind of a staple in a lot of Stephen King ones. I'm starting to realize now between this and Graveyard Shift.
If you're, like, an outsider, fuck off, basically.
Yeah, it's like, basically, it's like, we hate you because you're new to this town and stuff like that.
So when he's in his class, automatically the jocks are like, well, we're just here to pass
so
we can play football. And he's like, no, I'm not taking any of that shit. So then they tell on him with the principal.
Yep.
And then as the bullies start emerging, because as we said, it was 27 years ago.
Yep.
They start killing off his students and...
kind of replacing them.
They, yeah, replace them in the class. But then pretty soon Jim, because he's been around them all, close to their deaths, he sort of gets suspected on killing them when he's being like, no, someone else murdered them. And no one really believes him until they go after his kid. I think his kid's Scott.
Yeah, Scott. Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. And still his wife thinks he's a bit deluded until the bullies come to their house. So it all leads to, like, the big showdown with how he's got to get rid of them. He's got to remember what to do and, you know, reface that tragedy again. So, yeah.
Well, that's kind of like a staple, of, again, of Stephen King's work. Like,
that's why it is kind of reminiscent of It, because you see through, the, like, the flashbacks of what happened.
Yep.
And then he has to kind of relive that same thing again while fighting off. I guess you could say they're his demons from the past.
Yeah.
But in the movie, they're real sort of things.
Well, I know because the short story is does have things in it that didn't appear in the movie. I think how the bullies died is very different. They didn't get run over by a train. They were in a high-speed pursuit after when they killed Wayne, and they smashed into a pole.
Oh, okay.
And also, I think there's also the wife character played by in the film by Brooke Adams. She gets killed by them.
Oh.
And so Jim actually conjures up a demon to kill the bullies. So there's definitely elements that didn't get transported over. But I think what they sort of changed here for the film, at least even though I haven't read the original short story myself, but having read it up on what it's about, actually does work. And for me, the whole sort of the heart of this film is that is Jim's relationship with his brother Wayne. And you kind of, with the flashbacks, you see that they actually do love each other, and Wayne really does look out and care for Jim. And then when he gets murdered, it really is devastating to Jim. And then at the end there,
instead of conjuring up a demon, he conjures up Wayne.
Yeah, so there's actually one bully who actually did survive the train wreck, and he was, I think, the character...
It was Carl. Mueller.
Yeah, Mueller, played by William Sanderson. And he's kind of like this character who has been regretful of what happened. And so when he dies, it almost, like, pretty much the bullies have to kill someone for them to come back. So Mueller dies, and that's when, since Wayne was part of the whole accident as well, he comes back and he helps out. And then it ends with this scene kind of like with him and... and to me, this is like one of the most touching scenes in the film, because I actually... was got misty-eyed during the scene where it's just basically Wayne's like, because now that everything's been set right, Wayne can actually move on.
Yeah, because we find out he's kind of in a limbo.
Yeah.
He didn't go to heaven.
Yeah. And Wayne's like, oh, Jim, I want you to come with me. But he's trying to, and now I'm thinking about this now, because I'm getting misty-eyed thinking about this now, is this basically like, Jim's telling him I can't go because I got a family now. And Wayne sort of at first when he sees Jim, he doesn't believe like,
it's him and
stuff. Yeah, because so much, the years have gone by so fast. So it's a really beautiful and poignant moment, and actually makes it even more moving. Because I don't know, it's just like, again, it's like that sort of, like it. It has that sort of dynamic between brothers. And we kind of saw a bit more of that in the recent It Chapter 2, where it's about with the brothers kind of reconciling in some way, or him sort of letting go.
Yeah.
And here it's just done really well, and it's quite moving, and it, to me, it's the real heart of the film and makes me sort of appreciate Tim Matheson's performance, because, like, I can definitely see there are definitely hokey moments throughout the whole film, and again, it was produced for TV, so you have those kind of aspects, but I feel like the emotional core of the film really just elevates it to... make it work overall.
Yeah, I think having that brotherly relationship was a good aspect. It was a strong aspect of the movie, even though one of the brothers obviously got killed, but it still really works, especially with that kind of end scene and how everything works together. Like, you know, Wayne can be at peace now, so can Jim with all of that. And yeah, it's really well done. And yeah, I think it's a really enjoyable movie. It's not too over the top. It's not too hokey. It's a good story. And again, it doesn't feel like it's a TV movie.
Yeah, I was actually kind of surprised that it was a TV movie. Because I think compared to, say, the miniseries and also the next couple of Stephen King miniseries we'll be talking about, those felt very much like TV shows. This one, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised maybe this was made originally to be a theatrical release, but that it ended up going to TV. I mean, for me, it could have easily been released in cinemas, and it's kind of surprising being that it's a TV movie and end up having, like, two direct-to-video sequels. which were amazingly titled, Sometimes They Come Back Again, and Sometimes They Come Back For More.
Yeah. probably pass on those.
Although I hear the second one is hilariously bad, and it actually contains elements from the original short story
in
that one, apparently. So I have to... And also has Hilary Swank in
it. Yes, so. I know that she's in it. We won't be discussing it on the podcast because this is, you know, obviously...
We're talking about more actual films, TV movies, miniseries that are actually based on... On his actual work rather than...
Sequels to things.
Yeah, so we won't be reviewing any of the Children of the Corn sequels.
Thank God. I like that it really... It didn't have that TV feel.
Yeah.
And it didn't hold back. Like, there are some gruesome moments, especially when you see them without their faces.
Oh, yeah, the makeup and...
It's pretty good.
The makeup effects were really cool.
They look really, I guess I could use the word, like, they look really legit.
Yeah.
They didn't look really fakeish or hokey.
Yeah.
You use that word a lot in this podcast, but there you go. no, they looked really good, and they were kind of gross. I'll give them that. I'd say probably, like, the poorest performance, at least in my opinion, was from Chad... Chad Norgris?
I guess Nigris, who played Chip,
the head jock. He was a bit shit. Like, I'm just going to be frank.
He looks at least about 35 years old.
He does. He really just didn't work.
He looks older than Tim Matheson. So
yeah, his performance just did not work for me. I didn't mind Matt Nolan as Billy.
I thought he was good.
He was good, but unfortunately, he's not in it that long.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish he was, because there was an interesting character in there, which I liked, but we just didn't get a lot of.
Oh, yeah. I also really liked the character of Kate, played by if I butcher this actress's name, forgive me, Tasia Valenza?
Yeah.
I thought she was really good, too.
She was good as well. And again, it's a case of she wasn't in it as much as you probably wanted her to be in it.
Yeah, but I think between sort of her and the Billy character, like the movie, even though we don't spend enough time with these characters, they give us enough so we actually do care about it. And when the bullies do kill them off, we actually do feel something when they die.
Yeah.
Chip is kind of like, well...
Chip, I don't give a shit, really. His character was a dickhead.
Well, I will give the film credit for actually him kind of changing as a character. Yeah. Because he is a dick, and then he realizes, like, something is going on. Yeah. And he realizes the bullies who he idolizes...
Yeah.
...were, of course, really bad.
Yeah, so he kind of feels bad, but then... You know, he gets chopped up into little pieces and no one cares.
Yes.
At least I didn't care, because it's Chip, and Chip sucks.
Yes. and of course, what do we think of, the character of Scott, who's the son, played by Robert Hart Gorman? I probably butchered his name,
Yeah,
too.
I feel like I've seen him in stuff, but
I have too, but I can't think of what they were, what else he was in.
We'll just go to his IMDb page. See, he was Felix in Forever Young. I know where I found him.
And
he
also
was Alex in Leprechaun.
Yes.
And Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Pretty much all these movies coming around the same time.
Yeah, that's why I knew who he was. I just needed to look him up. He was in Mr. Nanny.
That explains absolutely everything.
Yeah, now it all makes sense. Now I know who he was. Yeah.
But, overall...
I thought the son-father relationship was really good.
Yeah, I thought so, too. And also the wife dynamic. Husband and wife dynamic, too. Because I guess, it's kind of a standard kind of wife kind of role. But I think Brooke Adams brought a lot to that character.
Yeah. And they feel like a normal family who obviously has issues with the dad going mad at times.
Yeah.
But it works pretty well.
Yeah, exactly. But overall, I think sometimes they come back is definitely... I really enjoyed this one a lot, especially on a repeat viewing. Mm. And I really got a lot more out of it. I think it sort of hit me more emotionally compared to the first time I watched it. Because pretty much anything to do with family always gets to me on an emotional level. So this one really got to me on that regard. But I think it's just an overall really solid, strong TV movie. And like I pretty much have no problems with it. Like it's well acted. The villains are very menacing and great. And it finds that perfect balance of having all the hallmarks of King's work without it being too over the top.
Yeah.
But also it's serious enough like that it's not too serious, like say, like we
Graveyard Shift.
Exactly. Yeah. But it really has that sort of, it just works on a dramatic, emotional and thematic level. And
it's got a really good balance of everything.
Yeah. And I would say this is definitely one, even though I know this one has a bit of a cult following as well, it's definitely without a doubt, I think, one of the more underrated Stephen King adaptations.
Yeah, I'd say so as well. Overall, I just found it really enjoyable, easy to watch. You know, you're invested in it straight away.
Yep.
And I think, yeah, it just hits all the right notes, and it works really well.
Yep. But what would your rating be for this one?
I'm probably going to end up giving this 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I think I would say 3.5 out of 5 for me, but I really do like this one a lot, and I wouldn't be I will admit I guess my only downside is, like Graveyard Shift, some of the pacing can be a bit slow at times, because there was, even though it only goes for 100 minutes, there were times where I did check my watch, and it got to a point where it was like, oh, it must be the end, and I realized there's still 20 minutes to go.
Yeah, I didn't find that on my watch. Like, I was pretty invested, and I wasn't really looking at the time or anything, and yeah, by the time it was finished, it's like, oh, it's over already kind of thing. So, a bit different for me, but yeah, no, I think it's a solid 4 out of 5.
Yeah, 3.5 out of me, but I wouldn't be surprised it might go up on another viewing.
It's definitely worth a watch. It's pretty damn good, and I think it's one of the better TV movies out there, especially horror thriller.
Actually, you know what? I'm going to change my rating. I'm going to make it a 4, because I think talking about it now and discussing it with you, it's definitely made me even more appreciative in this conversation. But yeah, I do agree. I think, yeah, because as we all know, the TV movies and miniseries can be very hit and miss.
I think it's more like the miniseries end up being a bit shit.
Yeah, but
let's just be real.
Yeah, but I can definitely say that, and we will be talking about all those very soon in future episodes.
Yeah.
But I think definitely sometimes They Come Back is definitely one of the stronger TV adaptations of King's work, for sure.
Yeah, so I guess that probably wraps up our podcast for this one. We've kept it under an hour, so that's good. We only had the 2 movies to discuss.
Yeah, and we didn't have a guest on to talk about these ones. So
So where can people find us on our social media?
Well, they can find us at our Twitter page at twitter.com/SM_SuperNetwork. And of course, if they want to find either of us, they can find you at twitter.com/supermarcy or myself at twitter.com/BJermaine. And of course, if people want to find us at our Facebook, they can find our official Facebook page for The Super Network at facebook.com/TheSuperNetwork, and as well as our group page, which is The Super Network group. So you can, that link for that is up on the official page. So
it doesn't have like an actual link that says the groups don't have like names in the addresses. You just got to write in The Super Network group on Facebook.
Yeah. And I think it's one that's a private one. So basically you have to send us a request to get in, and then we'll allow you in. So, also people can find all of our podcasts, whether it be The Super Podcast, The King Zone, or as well as Podcasters of Horror, and also our upcoming other new episode shows that we're in developing at the moment, which we will be doing once I get back from my trip. You can find all those at the following streaming platforms, which include iTunes, Stitcher Podcasts, CastBox, and Spotify. And if you want to, also leave us a rating and review over at iTunes, so that way it gives our podcast more exposure. And also, if you want to email us, you can email Marcy and I at the supernetwork sm@gmail.com.
Yep.
And I'm trying to think, I know I'm missing something, but I can't think. Oh, yes. If people want to find any of our writings, they can find this all at supermasty.com.
Yep.
All of our reviews and columns in there. And if you want to check out my column, Horror Down Under, just check it out over at thescreencast.com.
Well, I'll mention creators for Bushfire Relief, mm-hmm. so raising money for charity. So you can go to facebook.com/creators for Bushfire Relief. There's a Facebook page and group. You can also, well, maybe by the time this is up, I think it might be out to order, but pre-orders are up for Australia Burns anthology book, and that's australiaburns.bigcartel.com. And I think that's it.
Yep. Actually, before we finish up, I've just realized I almost forgot while doing my research on both these movies. There is actually a common theme between Graveyard Shift and Sometimes They Come Back, which have nothing to do with Stephen King.
Oh.
And that because both movies actually feature a star who was in the Nightmare on Elm Street series. Because as we know, Robert Rossler was in A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, but David Andrews, who was the lead in Graveyard Shift, had a small role in the first Nightmare on Elm Street film. Well,
there
as well.
You go.
So somehow, even though we just randomly put these two movies together, we found a common link between them.
Yes, we did. And with that, we'll bid you farewell. And until next time, I've been awesome.
I've been terrible, and you have all been in the King Zone.
Catch you later.
See you, everyone. Bye.
Let's go surfing now, everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me. Come on a safari with me.
Early in the morning we'll be starting out. Some honeys will be coming along. We're loading up our woody with our boards inside and heading out singing our song.
Come on baby, wait and see.
Yes, I'm gonna take you surfing with me.
Surfing now, everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me. Everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me. Come on a safari.
We're going to hell.